Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
Previously on Campaign Confessions.
I like 13th Age. I thought it was as good as I expected.
The escalation die is a great mechanic.
What did you think, Wayne?
I hate all you people who asked for the Bane voice to come back. That's what I think.
And without further ado, 13th Age.
And welcome to part two of Campaign Confessions 13th Age. And just to pull the curtain back a bit, we are recording this well after we recorded these episodes. Because we wanted this intro to be fresh.
Right.
And it is fresh because we have some fresh news of we seeing Guardians of the Galaxy. Is that fresh?
Well, it depends on who you're asking.
Seeing as how it came out like mid-September here in Japan, it's fresher than back in the States.
Yeah, and we actually saw it a couple of weeks ago, but then we had the interviews.
Right.
But we had quite a movie crew that came together. A couple comic book fans joined us.
And then me and Chris.
Yeah, I'm a superhero fan and a sci-fi fan. And I like comics.
So what did you guys think of the movie?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. Actually, I think I enjoyed it more than Avengers.
Yeah, I definitely liked it more than Avengers, but I didn't like Avengers all that much. I enjoyed it, even though it didn't...
He's now trying to walk back the enjoyment.
Right.
It was great.
Put some displeasure.
Because, you know, we've established that for me, hate and love, that's a very, very fine line. But, yeah, that... All right, fair enough. I enjoyed it even though there was nothing really innovative or groundbreaking about it, so.
Yeah, there were some huge plot holes in it, but that's really the only negative thing I can say for it. It wasn't deep or anything either, but man, the characters were a lot of fun. They felt like something right out of the real comic book or something like a character that you would play in a game. Drax, he stole the show. He was played by Dave Bautista, who I guess was a professional wrestler back in the day, so.
Or he might still be. I don't know if he's...
I don't
follow wrestling, but yeah. No, he was really good. I saw him in the third Riddick movie, which I think is called Riddick.
I haven't seen that one yet.
It's a lot like the first movie, except they could hire more people.
Right.
But yeah, he was all right in that, but I think he really got to shine in Guardians of the Galaxy, even though I guess the big joke was his people don't understand metaphors.
Except they obviously do.
Because then he started using metaphors in the movie. And you're like, I guess that was a pretty hard thing to establish since, I mean, metaphors are so common.
Right.
So, for example, if people wonder what we're talking about, calling Zoe Saldana's character a whore, even though there is no, I mean, she didn't establish that she was a prostitute. So calling her that would be a metaphor in a sense.
I thought it was just plain out rude. But
that as well, but they didn't establish that his race couldn't be rude.
Fair enough. All right, they didn't. Wouldn't a better one have got to be just when he called a group of people the paper people? And you're like, okay, unless they were literally made out of paper.
Well, I mean, that was one of the ones we talked about.
Right.
Yeah. So, no, I really enjoyed it too. I agree that Drax stole the show. I think also the animated guys, Rocket Raccoon and Groot, did a good job.
Yep.
I think we've seen Chris Pratt's character a lot in movies, so it wasn't a big surprise. I think a lot of credit should go to Keith Giffen, who was one of the people behind Marvel Annihilation when that came out.
Okay.
Which is a really, really solid comic series or event. So if people haven't had a chance to read that, and it's different from the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, but similar enough that if you enjoyed that movie, you would certainly enjoy this comic book series. Yeah, it was one of the reasons why I got the Marvel Unlimited subscription, so I can read that, and so I could read Planet Hulk. And those were great, and then I'm like, I just read Infinity, and wow, what a disappointment that was. So,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the movie. We didn't see it in 3D, thank goodness. But, I don't know, just maybe it's because I'm not a comic book person, and so I was being introduced to these characters for the first time, but I didn't understand all the hype around it, like with Avengers again. I'm just like, okay, it was okay. Not to the level of, you know, rabid fandom that I saw on social media. Like people going to see it 2, 3, 4 times. I'm like, really?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's worth that much, but it was fun.
I think it would be worth, you know, seeing in the big screen, which is too late for anybody listening.
Even for
but
us.
But then
here.
Watching it as soon as it came on DVD, I think it was that good.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I could watch again at home.
Yeah, it was fun. I think a movie like Battleship was a lot of fun, where when it came out on DVD, I could watch that again. So.
Yeah. Guardians of the Galaxy was no Battleship, because Battleship's just better.
Just an underrated movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a lot of fun, that movie, Battleship. But yeah, a strength of Guardians of the Galaxy was there just to have a lot of fun. Whereas Avengers seemed to be, I don't know what they're trying to do there.
Set a lot of stuff up?
Yeah, set a lot of stuff up. I think Marvel's doing too much of that now, and it's just getting, and I'm done with the end credit scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, okay, credits are rolling. I'm going to the bathroom. Well, don't you want to see the end spoiler? No, I don't care.
Thousands of people have worked on these movies, and then we got to watch Howard the Duck. Yeah, sorry, spoiler.
Hey, everybody's seen it.
Leave. And then I think Chris was going, oh, yeah, there's a really funny line at the end of the credits, and it was like, no raccoons or trees were harmed in this. Oh, whatever.
Oh, come on.
It was me, but okay.
Nerd humor. That's so funny.
So, it was good. I would say top three Marvel movies right now are Iron Man the first, Captain America, Winter Soldier, and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Ooh, it's a tough call. I don't know. The first two Spider-Mans are really good, too.
No, I'm going to stand by my three.
I don't think Chris was trying to get you to change.
I'll get you next time, Lyle.
So now let's return to our 13th Age campaign confessions. The story itself was inspired by a few things. One was the story of the 10,000, the Greek mercenaries that got trapped in the Middle East and then had to fight their way back. Which was also an inspiration for the classic movie The Warriors. So again, that was an inspiration.
That's why we ran into the Baseball Furies, all right.
Yeah. Well, actually, the Baseball Furies, the Painted Fae.
Did not make that connection.
Oh, yeah. What do you know?
There you go. So more on them in a sec. Another inspiration was the movie The Mist. Mm-hmm. And I think the players got that one right away because it was a mist.
and bad things came out
that
of it.
Tough.
Fog, a mist, and bad things came out of it.
Right.
As well as the Richard Adams book, Shardik, which I later found out is actually his favorite book. Hmm. And Shardik is about a bear. People think is like an avatar of a god. But there's one part of the book where the main character travels through what would be Badlands. And just kind of that story, which can be kind of boring, but I thought, you know, if you were like fleeing and running away, if people were to think, for example, Stalingrad, and they break out of the cauldron, and like the German soldiers trying to flee back to Germany, how would that be? And telling that story. So I decided to make it a military game. So the players would be officers or senior NCOs of a mercenary company. And they would be breaking out of a certain area with the remnants of their company. So the setup was they were part of this grand company, mercenary company, which actually had smaller mercenary companies attached to it. And I told the players, okay, make a mercenary company. You're quasi good,
right.
But other than that, anything's up for grabs. And they decided to make an artillery company, a magical artillery company.
Yeah, since we had a wizard, a sorcerer, and a fighter. He said, hey, we have a lot of magic power. We're kind of artillery.
Did you guys decide that after the characters, or did you come together and make the company and then build characters that fit into that company?
I'm pretty sure we came up with that after we saw what characters we had.
Yep.
Okay.
Because I know I just said, ooh, sorcerer, I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, ditto. I said, ooh, utility mage, I'm going to do that.
Right.
Yeah. So then I threw up a list of different companies that are in the Grand Company, and then they all have different names, and then the players came up with names for their company. And then the story opens with the Grand Company just getting annihilated in a battle where there was betrayal. And a lot of that was just told as in a prologue to the players.
Hmm.
And that was the setup. And then the idea was the mist was interfering with magical communication, and they're now encircled by the orc hordes. So they now need to break out and make their way to Forge, which is the main dwarven city.
Yeah, basically we were kind of like outside the Empire trying to stop this orc horde from, you know, getting into the Empire. Failed, got surrounded, and yeah, as Lyle said, it was a breakout that basically we had to get out and get back to Forge to warn the rest of the Empire that this massive orc horde and this mist was descending on the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much pretty tense setup, because pretty quickly got the sense that if we failed, nobody was going to get advanced warning of this massive incursion.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, and the players didn't have advanced warning that, okay, all this stuff, like you build it up, here's your company, and now we'll kind of break it. Mm-hmm. And now you're left with the survivors. And you had about 70 people under you, which was pretty big. And if I have one major regret, was trying to do a military-style game with a system that I hadn't game mastered before.
Right. Mm.
It was a bit ambitious, and it did become unwieldy at times.
Wasn't going to be my... I don't know if I was going to say complaint, but yeah, being in charge of 70, 80 NPCs between the three of us was a lot to track. And also, I think there was a little bit of a disconnect where, okay, you know, we're in charge of all these guys. Our characters have been part of this mercenary company for a long time and know how to get stuff done. We as players have never been in the military. We don't know the first thing about, or I don't know the first thing about, you know, packing up and getting everybody ready to move. So I think there were a couple times at the beginning, Lyle, where you said, okay, tell me what you want to do. You know, giving us lots of free rein and giving us the opportunity to make plans and get everybody ready, which was great. But from my perspective, I didn't know, as a player, I didn't know the first thing about getting everybody ready. And there were a couple times I wanted to say, my character would know what to do. Can we just say it happens? I don't know if you felt that way too, Chris.
I didn't, actually. Okay. I was going to say that I thought you did very well in running the military aspect of it, Lyle, in that you didn't require us to do a lot of the nitty-gritty things, such as preparations and orders and group tactics. Though you did bring in the dramatic elements. When there were times when the men's morale was down, we needed to pick it up with some speeches. And actually, as a huge compliment to you, Wayne, you excelled at that. You gave some really great speeches during the game. I was very impressed.
That was fun. I kind of bagged on the military thing a little bit, but yeah, that was fun. And mm-hmm. using the guys, you know, seeing some of them desert or you know, watching other NPCs like chide people as they're walking away and trying to get them to all work as a unit. I liked that. Yeah, that was great for the dramatic stuff. But yeah, I'm going to agree with Lyle. It became a little bit unwieldy when we got into combat and we're like, oh yeah, now we got to figure out what these 40 guys are doing, and we didn't really make stats for them, and what do we roll, and
yeah.
can I just take my turn?
On the numbers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, actually, I think the combat that I enjoyed the most was the one with the black pudding early on, and I think one of the reasons for it was that we actually got into the tactics. We talked about how the different squads spread out, how they distributed themselves, and it's not that we didn't really continue doing that in later ones, but that's because a lot of the later combats involved being on the water where we couldn't maneuver correctly,
yeah.
And we lost a lot of our different kinds of squads and resources, so it wasn't really a feasible thing to do.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the first two major combats, one was the breakout, and that's how the 70 became 40. After the breakout, a lot of the infantry, and that's their job, is to protect the magical artillery, and which they did with their lives.
Right.
And it wiped them out almost to a man, which meant for a very interesting dynamic, because you have a very, very powerful artillery that's completely exposed now.
Mm-hmm.
So they became a lot more difficult to use. And the Black Pudding, again, was another open environment. And yeah, like you guys were able to do a little bit more with them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you had less because we had split it up in the mist and you couldn't see where half of them were. So I guess you had less to work with. So that was made it more manageable. And I think once you went into the Underroad, which is like an old dwarven kingdom, they became a real burden.
Yeah, they did, yes.
They did a little bit,
to the point where you... And it was not like... I guess story-wise, maybe you wouldn't have done this, but system-wise, yeah, you needed to do this, where you go, hey, you guys flee, and us, the PCs, will take on this opponent just because you couldn't deal with them. They became more of a liability than an asset.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm trying to think of the word, but yeah, once we got underground and once we were going through the Underroad, they did become a little bit of a burden. But at the same time, I think they became a great tool for you, Lyle, to motivate the players, because I think you had said they were all level one, you know, kind of guys. And so the types of, or the level of monsters we were fighting against to give us, the PCs, a challenge meant that these soldiers were pretty much getting one-shotted. So you didn't have to track hit points. So we, both as players and characters, knew how fragile these guys under our command were. And watching their ice boats get pulled down by this tentacle monster, or watching, you know, swaths of them get cut down as we're trying to get into the Underroad and this other, you know, trader company is riding us down, or, you know, seeing the Sahagwin just kill these guys in droves was kind of painful as a character, because you're like, I'm supposed to protect these guys and I can't.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I mean, there are a couple, you know, dramatic times where I'm like, great, there goes an ice boat under the water, I just gotta dive after these guys and try and save somebody.
Right. So, and you really had to recalculate what you were going to do too, because retreating was an option, but you didn't get to retreat when things went bad. You had to think a few steps ahead when things were going to go bad, so you could call the retreat and cover the escape of the NPCs.
Right. So they did become a burden, but I think they became a great tool for you, Lyle, to, you know, kind of put the screws to us as characters and maybe make situations dangerous that we wouldn't really normally feel were dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the motivations and one of the reasons why I wanted to incorporate them. There was an encounter where I had planned, but you guys never went in that particular direction. You didn't take that path. And if you had taken that path, you would have encountered a village who could see the mist approaching, so would entreat you to take all their children.
Mm.
And then you guys would have been tied down with children. And I think it was just about halfway through the story, the actual mercenary company became the equivalent of the children.
Right.
Where they were there good for like a dramatic effect as the creature, the monster pulls them under the water and then there's panic. But yeah, if you were doing a retreat, you wouldn't, you know, as the officers, you wouldn't detach a group and say, you're the rear guard and buck up guys, because you thought, well, they're not even going to be a speed bump.
Right. You know,
they're not slowing down anybody. So you would be like, all right, you guys go, we're the rear guard.
And let's hope you don't run into anything worse farther down the tunnel.
And it was during that rear guard, one of the rear guard actions, that the Sahagwin actually took down Chris.
Yes.
And then it became more of a traditional type adventure, because then it was, oh, well, everybody else is gone. So it was only the player characters left. So you guys went into to rescue Chris.
Yeah. Then it did become a much more traditional kind of dungeon crawly adventure, where, as you said, it was only the PCs, because we had sent the rest, what was remained of the mercenary company, on ahead.
Yeah. But I did like especially those are some of my favorite parts of the game, were the moments where, you know, Wayne had to step up and make a speech. The first one was, this is the situation, we're surrounded, we got to break out, that speech.
Right.
And I made Wayne roll.
Oh, man, that was an epic speech. I wish we had recorded it as an actual play, and my roll was a straight-up one.
Yep.
First roll of the game, and it was a one.
And that, I mean, people discuss what to do in a situation like that, where they're like, well, is it role-playing or rolling the dice playing? And, I mean, that's tough, because you think, well, people build their characters, so if you're just going to role-play everything, and they can fast talk or give an inspired speech and then you hand wave everything, then what was the point of making a lot of those stats?
Right, right.
And having those stats. So it did have an effect where I said, well, it was actually really, really good speech. So it has a better effect than the die suggests, but some negative. So some people did desert after
people
that.
Still leave, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then about, not quite halfway through, but they had a chance to rest. And the player characters had decided that, well, this is actually a dangerous situation. It was this sorceress who has all of these...
weird feral men under her control.
Yeah, and she made it. Wow. She would provide them assistance if they were to provide 3 to 5 of the troops to join her family.
Right, and we got the distinct impression that people were going to this, some kind. We felt like some kind of charm was going on, and that the men may not be joining under their own free will. And so we said nuts to that,
which was correct. But the sorceress did say, "Well, you have to leave then."
Right.
And this is where it was pretty dramatic, because you guys had said, "Okay, you guys, don't
camp down
relax,
for the night."
But
yeah,
but you can camp down.
So then, and then about 10 minutes of game time later. Come back. Okay, right, pack up. Let's move.
Well, I was actually giggling at this was Wayne's second big speech, where he made this great impassioned speech all the way up to the end, where he said, "You can come with us and save the Empire. You can stay here and be safe."
Like, wait, yeah.
Yeah. Well. And people were like, "All right, safe sounds good."
I didn't mean safe.
Did I say safe? I didn't really mean it. Yeah.
But that was a good speech, and. You guys had asked for some alone time to discuss the situation, so the sorceress was like, fine. So she went out and charmed a couple of the guys. So she had created agitators within the group to argue with the officers, saying, well, no, we're safe, we're tired. Why do we need to do this? You know, we need to think about ourselves. But no, another great speech. And then there was a really good speech at the end, but where there was a bit of a division. And then Wayne made a speech that everybody overheard, but he's kind of making it to Chris's character, that they had to complete the mission, and he made some analogy to what, you know, the great gold worm is, you know, making the sacrifice to keep the demons at bay, so we need to make a sacrifice. So, and then at that point, it was a really, really good speech, so I didn't make him roll. I just said, you know, I can't imagine any of these guys abandoning the situation.
Not good enough to sway Chris's character, apparently.
yeah, true.
So I guess what happened is, after things kind of became a more typical dungeon crawl, characters ran into a bunch of Sahagwin led by some kind of toad demon. I think it's like a Hezrau. And the deal for us to escape was we would have to kill Yujiro's character so that the dwarf lord didn't get his hands on, you know, Yujiro's PC and open up the Hall of Vengeance and get the Axe of Seven Bloods.
Just to back up a bit.
Sorry.
Yujiro had left at that point.
Yeah.
So Yujiro's one unique thing brought us to the Underworld, as well as his role with the icons. So I determined that this key that he had was actually his blood. So the dwarves had created these things called bloodlocks. And they were actually the blood of each clan can unlock their locks. But, there's intermarriage. So what happens is dwarves actually will get the blood of different clans so they can open up more locks. And that actually broke the blood lock system, because people are like, okay, well, they're not really that secure anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But there are actually some dwarves, Yujiro being one of them, who has the blood of every clan in him. So that in other words, he can open all of the bloodlocks. And this Hall of Vengeance happens to have a special bloodlock that needs, lo and behold, the blood of all the clans. Maybe the Dwarf King knew that, maybe he didn't, who cares. But that was his key. And the Abelist had found this out and knew what would happen if the Dwarf King had gotten a hold of the this axe of the Seven Bloods. And it's alluded to in the 13th Age book, because it says, you know, this would be a problem if the Dwarf King were to get this, because then he'd be too powerful.
Right.
And Wayne actually rolled well with his relationship with the Diabolist, so he got clues in the form of visions of, like, a grinning frog saying a tongue for flies, but not for lies, just to foreshadow the fact that this demon can't lie. It can only tell the truth.
Right, and unfortunately we didn't like the truth it was telling.
Yeah.
So it was telling some pretty terrible things would happen if, you know, the Dwarf King got this axe. And so the deal we made with this Hezrau demon was, okay, we agreed to kill Yujiro's character so that the Dwarf King didn't get this axe, and in return, the demon would join his Sahaguin army with the defenders of the Empire and kind of ensure that, you know, that this orc incursion didn't get very far. The downside is if we got to, you know, this certain point and hadn't killed Yujiro's character and provided proof, well, then the Sahaguin would join the orcs and we'd have that many more people or that many more creatures descending upon the Empire. So, I don't know about you, Chris, but I think we discussed a little bit, you know, via IMs to each other, not knowing what else to do to get out of that situation since we were so horribly outnumbered by all these Sahaguin. We just said, okay, fine, we'll do it.
With no actual intention of doing it.
Right, with no intention of actually doing it, but no real idea of how we were going to get out of doing it. So, came up. Unfortunately, the Hezrau demon sent one of his little dwarven servitors along with us to make sure that this happened, and my incredibly clever plan to fool him was basically knock everybody off this boat into the water. Chris
was covering for my nuts,
brilliant
so
compared to
brilliant.
Chris's plan, which was to pretend to cut. Well, Chris, what was your idea? You tell it.
Well, the good part of my plan was that we staged the revealing that we were sent to kill him and a big fight between him and made it look like we killed him in front of the dwarven servitor of the demon.
Right, that so part was good.
Yeah, we tricked him into thing. And then, I'm not quite sure how it happened. On the way down to meet Yujiro's character after making the deal with the demon, we figured that we could wash away his blood, but we'd need some extra blood. And then before we knew it, we were there with him and kind of doing the fight, though we didn't have any blood. So my thought was still on the idea that we can show that we can, since his blood was special, we could show the blood washing away in the river, but I didn't know where else to get any blood, so I carried his body into the river and then cut myself so that I would started bleeding into the river. And then I rolled very poorly on a bluff check, and the guy's like, yeah, he's not dead, he's not bleeding, and yeah, that kind of sucked.
Well, I think what tripped you up, Chris, is the demon said, if something along the lines of, we want to watch Yujiro's character's blood wash away into the river, right?
So I tried to recreate that.
Yeah,
what they wanted to do.
Unfortunately, I think that was just, you know, a way of saying we want him dead. Didn't actually mean we want to dump his blood into the river. So, like, as Chris's character has cut himself and is
bleeding in the river.
Out, pretending this to be Yujiro's character's blood, and Lyle is very cleverly narrating about how Chris's character is getting fainter and fainter and fainter from this loss of blood. I just said, I don't know what else to do. Knocked everybody into the river and kind of hoped for the best.
Yeah, there was that point where, like, how far do you want to do? Go here, dude. How much blood do you want to come out of you?
Yeah.
And there was a point, like, because, you guys were like, well, of course we can kill him. And he's like, oh, that's fine. So the demon says, well, we'll kill him. You just bring it to him. We'll kill him.
Right.
So the blood won't be on your hands. In fact, bring him to us. And there was all these deals. And then you guys were talking, and later on and it sounded like you had forgotten. He would said that you have to produce the body and actually produce him alive so that he can ensure that he dies.
Right, I think we got tripped up.
Well, we're going to be just bring him something. Like, right, no, you actually got to bring him the body.
Yeah, we I think we got tripped up on that. We knew we had to bring him proof, the demon proof that Yujiro's character was dead. So after, you know, very cleverly knocking everybody in the river, I just decided to strangle this, you know, dwarf servitor Because, hey,
it's funny because
which was
the guy who
lives... Why didn't you just shoot him with a spell?
Because I was trying to make it look kind of like an accident, right?
So we were trying to drown him, but he had spent a great portion of his life in the water,
right?
As a prophet or a disciple of this
Sahagun demon, yeah,
yeah.
That wasn't one of my better
trying
ideas.
Trying to drown him wasn't like a great idea. So he was starting to drown you,
right?
And then Chris came, and yeah. But you guys did it in the end.
We did it. And then the plan was to use one of Chris's utility spells to disguise this dwarf corpse to look like Yujiro's character, so that we would have proof to present to the demon when we met up with them kind of at the end of our journey. So we, got to the end of the journey, started heading off towards Forge to meet the Dwarf King, because there was time for us to do that before we had to meet, the Sahagwin demon. And that's when Chris just chose to disappear.
Yeah, Chris had done a role with the High Druid, and I was trying to think of how can I use that, because it was like a complicated role. And like with the Sorceress, I wanted to present, a dilemma. Or with the Demon Lord, here's a dilemma. What do you guys do? Mm. So in this dilemma, other servitors of or other NPCs who had a relationship with the High Druid approached Chris as well as the rest of the group and said, okay, she can actually rescue you.
Mm-hmm.
The deal is she's heard about the power that this dwarf has, Yujiro's dwarf has, so you can take him to the Wild Wood. Of course, he's going to be stuck there for the rest of his life, because the Dwarf King can't get a hold of him, but you will be safe from what happens.
Right.
And actually, the druid wanted this mist to roll in and this orc to roll in to, reset the balance and in favor of nature. So thinking this chaos that was coming would destroy a bit of the civilization to allow nature to take a greater hold over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you were totally cool with that.
I personally, I didn't think it was the moral choice to do, but, I was looking over my character sheet about who my connections were and kind of the life that I had, the background they had, and it seemed to make pretty good sense for the character that, I'd been thrown out of the Elven Kingdom and, owed a lot to the High Druid for saving me after that. So, yeah, why not? I trusted her opinion. She was giving me this advice, so it sounded good. Even though I knew that it actually wasn't in real terms.
Right. And meanwhile, my character's relationship with the Great Gold Worm and negative with the Diabolist, the fact that demons were kind of coming out of, or at least in this fog, I didn't like that. And that toad demon, that Hezrau thing that we had made a deal with, had implied that this mist was kind of completely chaotic, and that it was a good balance to the stability that the stability in a negative sense that the Dwarf King would set up if he got this Axe of the Seven Bloods. And I didn't like either of those things happening, but I knew I didn't want the world to get overrun by this demon-filled fog. So, yeah, I was like, nope, my character is going to stay, and that's when I gave another speech about, how the Great Gold Worm is chucked himself into the abyss to make sure that the world isn't overrun by demons, and just, going off into the Wild Wood where we'll be safe kind of seems like spitting in his face. But, so when Chris's character said, yeah, we'll take that, I was like, well, I guess we're splitting the party then.
Yeah. So, but actually, a big kudos to you, Lyle. Afterwards, the wrap up to the story at the end after, that went, and then meeting with those icons and how we had kind of a final moment of somewhat closure at the very end. I thought that was a really good way to end the game as well. So that's nicely done too.
when Chris went to the Wild Wood, yeah, we did kind of his conclusion. So, in the book, it would be the conclusion, although he later had an epilogue. And,
right.
And then I just said, well, and now your story ends. And then it switched to Wayne, and that story continued.
And
going to the Dwarf King, offering the proof, which actually was way back at the very first session that one of the mercenary companies whose role was to help with the breakout, but they weren't going to survive. They were just there to ensure that the messengers got out. They were called the Banner of the Four Winds, and they have banners. Kind of, if you watch a Kurosawa Akira movie like Ron, you see like the flags in the back of the samurai.
Right.
Like they have, and gave one of these banners to give to her sister. Yeah, so you produce that, and you're like, well, you know, obviously somebody from the Banner of the Four Winds is not just going to give their banner to anybody. And there was an NPC with you who has this book, artillery book, and we're also supposed to give this to Anvil, the capital.
Right.
Yeah, right. So that was really clever. I didn't expect you to do that.
Well, I just said, yeah, I had these things. Okay, the Dwarf King wants proof that I am who I say I am. Here you go. And I think it's worth pointing out that at that point, despite having set up the plan with Chris to use a utility spell to disguise this dead dwarf's body, Chris's character left before we actually said, and we do it.
Mm-hmm.
So...
yeah, he's the one that was the expert.
Right. So we kind of retconned it and said, okay, you know, the mages that are left in the group can kind of do it.
Well,
but
we didn't really retcon it because Chris had actually set that up and said...
Right, okay.
Because we were saying, how powerful is this disguise? I'm thinking, well, a demon lord, and you're going to cast this utility disguise self on something else.
Right.
You know, how feasible is that? But then Chris said, well, what if I use all of the remaining wizards that are in this mercenary company to help me with this? Would that speed along, make it stronger? And I said, that makes sense.
Right.
So then Chris, not necessarily retconned it, but Chris reminded us or suggested, well, these guys studied with me, so they might be able to do it on their own now.
Right. So
I was like, well, it was either that or kill Wayne's character. Sure.
Well, yeah. and I think I told this to Chris, but like the end of the story, my character going with this dead dwarf body that I knew wasn't proof, and I knew that demon pretty much could figure out truth from lies, almost, you know, supernaturally because it's a demon. I was pretty much prepared to just have my character die. I was not expecting to get out of that alive. I was just hoping to buy time so that the dwarf army could roll up and hopefully have time to deal with the Sahagwin before the orcs got there. Yeah, I was just hoping to stall them a little bit.
And you know, although we talk about, you know, narrative, story, and role-playing, it really came down to two dice rolls, two bluff checks.
Right, which I didn't expect to pass, but like nailed both of them apparently. Miraculously nailed both of them.
And one was about, you know, is this dwarf's body? And you actually kind of almost messed it up by unceremoniously dumping it on the ground.
Right.
I thought this was your friend. You're like, oh yeah, I'm kind of shaken up.
Right.
So there was nothing left to do but to go, all right, you wrapped it up and you all become heroes. And then you guys had like an epilogue where Chris is allowed to leave the wild wood. Of course, the High Druid sees that her plans are foiled and...
ha! Take that!
And screams, but... yeah, and then you guys had your conversation at the end. You know, Wayne's character is now in charge of the reformed Grand Company. And Chris's character is a pariah.
Wandering vagabond.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, yeah, I really... well, maybe it kind of sounds... I don't know. I'm patting myself on the back here at the end, but I really enjoyed the end of the game because I wasn't sure where things were going to go when we got intertwined with that demon, right? Mm-hmm. Just like, okay, I'm not really sure how we're going to get out of this. Not that I was going to think it wasn't going to be dramatic, but I was thinking, okay, it might come down to an epic kind of boss fight, which, okay, fair enough. But I think I kind of preferred the really tense skill rolls because even though you as GM, Lyle, had decided that the demon couldn't taste the blood or that, you know, you had decided that certain things were cheap and weren't going to happen.
But he could hear the lies because I had built it. And I got this, people who are fans of the comic book, The Demon, Etrigan the Demon is part of an order of demons that are rhymes or rhymers.
Right.
And I wasn't going to do rhymes, but I thought, oh, what if there's a demon order that in exchange for some power, they sacrifice the ability to lie. So they must always be truthful. But then I thought, if they're always being truthful, they're actually pretty good at stiffing out lies.
Right.
Which he wasn't.
apparently he wasn't. But
or not, yeah.
I, as a player, didn't know that. And the way you were in character answering my, what were bluff attempts, I didn't know if I had succeeded or not. You know, I would just say, yes, this is the body of the friend we were supposed to kill, and make a roll, and then you would just have the demon thing say, okay, I see, so this is that guy, all right? And I'm like, I don't know if that was a success or not. So when you would ask a follow-up question, I'm like, am I on really thin ice here, or am I kind of, you know, a bit safer? I don't know. So I really liked that. That was fun.
Yeah, you know, I always really enjoy it. I mentioned this during the game, but when it comes to a really tense die roll, and then you're kind of waiting for it, and you roll it out, and it's a good number, you're just like, yeah! Cheer for that. I mean, I know it's by chance, but man, that's always fun when that happens in a game.
I think in that situation, because Lyle, you hadn't really set us up to fail. You essentially just gave us enough rope.
We got there ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. You gave us enough rope and said, here, yo, hang yourself, which we did. So I would like to think that I would have been okay if my character died, because I was expecting to. But of course, I prefer the awesome outcome that happened.
Yeah, no, I mean, you guys had created a situation, and when you actually fooled me in the game and outside of the game, in that he had presented this scenario, you guys were communicating, and I guess this is one of the advantages of playing over Skype, although I do prefer to play in person.
Right.
Is that you guys were messaging each other, and I guess muting the Skype or something. I couldn't hear you guys typing. And you were formulating your plan, but everything I heard as the demon was you guys agreeing to the yeah. deal. And with mm-hmm. enough protests that I thought it was believable, or I didn't like make you roll or anything mm-hmm. to say convince. I mean, you put some conditions on it. You extended his life a little bit. You didn't have to do the killing yourself. So it fooled me both as a demon and as a game master. So it was really good. So then when you then revealed, no, we're not going to do it. We've got to do something else. I'm like, what? and then, which I liked as a game master, because it was completely unexpected. But I'm also like, well, how are you guys going to pull this off? Do you guys not understand the thousands of... Did you think I said dozens?
No.
Or was it like... And then you were talking, and it's like, you guys didn't hear me. Like, yeah. So
no,
like,
we
and then
heard
I think
you.
Wayne was saying, and it turns out you both had heard it, and Wayne had just repeated it. I'm like, yeah, Wayne's right.
Well, yeah.
That's what he said. But yeah, I was pretty stumped how you guys were going to achieve all the objectives and get out alive.
So were
which is,
we.
Which is one of the things where the Hydrood rescue came in. And it wasn't really a deus ex machina, because you guys were supposed to...
We would not
all
have...
Yeah, if you all had done it and all had saved yourselves, you actually would have failed the main mission.
Right.
Right.
But
right.
You guys split, which was kind of bad, you know, like a little tense and, you know, Chris abandoning it. But he actually managed to take away the dwarf, Yujiro's dwarf character, remove that threat, as well as saving his skin. Of course, Wayne was still in danger, but still it was like... you're probably going to die, because I can't see this
going
this thing
any other
working.
Way.
Yeah,
yeah, and
then,
we fully believed it as well.
Yeah,
and we didn't have any illusions about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so the die roll was also suspenseful for me, because I was like, all right, and you did it. Okay, I guess you're alive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Maybe much more begrudging for Lyle, but yeah.
Yeah.
I guess going back to what Lyle said about how Chris and I were communicating over Skype, full kudos to Chris, because, yeah, when we were talking to this demon, I just heard a little boo-boo, and I looked in at my Skype thing, and there was just this one word that said wink, and I'm like, oh, okay. So then...
Well, I was trying to be good about it. I didn't want to actually write a message away from Lyle, because it kind of feels like cheating, but I figured like a visual communication, an elbow nudge would be all
right. Right, right, which I thought was really good, because, yeah, again, not to, you know, pat ourselves on the back, but yeah, I agree, Chris. Sending like a message, like a fully written out message, would have felt like cheating, because you can't convey that in a single look, as I've tried in previous games. So just saying wink and then me saying something in character and then typing an exaggerated wink and sending it is something that you could have done in character, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
if we had been at the table with each other, yeah.
I don't know how we would have done it at the table, because
I would have just actually winked at
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and then, like, not that Lyle would have changed the plans based on what he saw, but then Lyle said he enjoyed being surprised. That would not have happened if we had mm-hmm. all been sitting at the table.
Yeah, I like that. That was fun. That was a fun little exchange.
Right. Then you took it a bit far when you said elbow nudge. And I'm like, okay, I think we're done here. Yeah.
Well, what about things to improve upon?
Well, we kind of touched on it when we talked about the icons mm-hmm. and the one unique things in the background. So I think now that we know ways that they can be used, and again, they provided examples in the book about different ways to use them, but now that we have a bit more familiarity with how to use them, I think it would be easier to incorporate the icon roles into the story, whether it was mm-hmm. the one role at the beginning to set the tone of everything, or, you know, a role kind of when a leg of the journey is completed or something like that. Also, maybe having stats on hand for all the NPCs under our control, because pretty much every time they had to do something in combat, we scrambled a bit to think up what stats they would have.
Yeah, I think that was a bit... There was this miscommunication there. I had said just build a stripped down one power first level characters. So not like first level characters, but just first level characters with one power.
Right, and one thing. We were obviously using first level characters, period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that they weren't put anywhere for anybody to easily access.
Right.
I should have gathered them and then put them somewhere. Like, we did have a communal Dropbox folder.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I didn't do that, and that was a failure. I think there was some organizational things. This was my first time running a game over Skype and using Roll20 as a game master, and I struggled a bit with the images and how to get that going. Have you gone? Can you see it? No. Can you see it? No.
Oh, how does this thing is? Yeah. How do I get this map out of here? Yeah.
There was also the. Where I couldn't get rid of that picture, the one with the topless picture.
Yeah, the topless sorcerer. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I found it from an 80s. What was it? Sword and the Sorcerer or something like that.
Something like that. I had looked it up. Yeah, it looks like a terrible movie. But there are a couple times.
But it
times...
was a great picture. And it was. I wanted her to be nude because of the back to nature. But also I thought it would be very disconcerting if you were to meet somebody surrounded by... And the men themselves were topless, so it was like equal opportunity nudity.
Mm-hmm.
And I got those pictures from the new Conan movie and the pics from that.
Right.
And then my wife came home and I had to hide Roll20.
Yeah. So had to like scroll quickly down the map. Like, hey, thanks for leaving that picture up there because you can't get rid of it.
Yeah. And that's one of the dangers that you're playing online is you've got people walking by and behind you. So you have stuff on your screen and, you know, a topless picture. And it's like, I thought you're playing a game with... your buddies. Oh, we are.
Yeah. We are. What kind of game?
Yeah, I'm exactly. I'm kind of interested to see what's inside these books that you keep on your shelves.
True.
But certainly, it was technically clumsy, especially in comparison to the way like Chris runs the game, who's much more technically adept. And,
well,
like stuff which like what we were supposed
said,
to
it was,
see.
It was a learning curve for me too. We had a lot of comments about that during our last campaign confessions.
And my hat's off to you, Lyle, because when I run a game online, I pretty much do voice only because I'm not good at juggling all the technical stuff that would go on a Roll20 thing.
So it became more and more voice only as it progressed, although I did attempt that maybe a 15-minute experiment with music, trying to use Roll20.
Which we couldn't mm-hmm. hear, yeah.
Yep,
yeah, can you hear that? No. Okay.
Nope.
Can you hear that? No. All right. So certainly there was that. And of course, the military thing I think is... really ambitious and adds an extra level of organization that I wasn't prepared for.
And this is an overly broad question, but how did you want us to feel about the men? And let me qualify it with saying how I actually felt. Is they felt more like a resource than actual people that we were taking care of. Because we were kind of in the race to get to the Dwarven City and the numbers were being taken down through combats and such. And besides the speeches, there wasn't that much actual interaction. And of course, that part is on us. But did you intend them to feel like a resource because it was supposed to be a countdown race atmosphere or not?
No, both. I mean, you're supposed to feel for them. They were a way for you to feel loss without necessarily having it inflicted upon yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But also to be a fun resource once the combat started. And even when you guys said they added elements of drama, I don't think that they were that fun as a resource. They were like, oh, it's their turn. Yeah, I'll make the roll, mm-hmm. and they fail. Okay. And trying to think of what you guys were going to do. So I think in a sense that they failed in both respects in some ways. Or they were a decent resource at the beginning and then less so.
Mm. Yeah,
and then when they switched to Burden, which was one of the things I wanted you to do because you could feel the loss and you feel some responsibility to save them. I think that came up at the end in a way.
Right.
But it was more like Wayne decided he didn't want to abandon the mission himself, mm-hmm. and then opened it up to everybody. You're welcome to join me. And then it kind of became more like a movie where everybody's like, well, we're not going to leave. And then there's the moment where he talks to the Dwarven King and then walks out and then they're all lined up. What are your orders, sir? You know, kind of like, you know, those are good moments, but I don't think mm-hmm. there were enough of them.
Yeah. I wonder if it's maybe part of the system. A level-based system doesn't work that well when with other people because they are so much of a lower level. So they don't have much of a chance to fight creatures that are on par with the characters.
I was actually okay with that because I'm sure from Lyle's perspective, if it was less bookkeeping he had to do, great, one hit from this monster means one of these guys is down and out. Mm-hmm. Nobody would want to track hit points for these 75 different guys.
Definitely, yeah.
They did kind of, as a resource, yeah, they weren't all that fun because, yeah, oh, it's their guy's turn. Okay, limited options. I'm kind of worried about what my guy's going to do next, and now I have to switch gears and think what this guy over here would do and his two or three or four buddies. Mm-hmm. If I were to, maybe a suggestion to, if you were going to do it again, Lyle, just have them completely narrative constructs. Don't worry about stats. Just say, okay, what are you going to have these guys do? Great, maybe it adds like a bonus to your die if you're all acting together, helping each other out. Or, great, okay, these guys are going to, I don't know, give the monster a minus because they're distracting it or something. And something less numbery. Not that numbers bogged it down.
Yeah.
But then you're right because towards the half or towards the last third of the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we kind of rejoined them and they started becoming a burden, as I said before, I really liked the drama they were causing, knowing that these guys were outclassed and knowing that my character was responsible for them and, you know, watching them die. Or, yeah, turning to them and saying, well, are you going to go with Chris's character or are you going to stay with me and try and save the Empire? Yeah, and then, you know, walking out of the Dwarf King's Hall and them all having them all be there and saying, nope, we're going to go out with you. That was great. So I think making them narrative only kind of allows them to fade into the background or kind of come into the spotlight a little bit easier if mm-hmm. you were to do it again.
I thought about that, but you remember I was saying that the Black Pudding combat was really interesting because we were able to use them tactically in the battle.
Yes, right. So I actually think
Wayne's got a really good idea, but I do agree with you as well, Chris. And there's nothing to say you can't start them out as more number-based
mm-hmm.
or that they switch and you just let the players know that now they're a narrative thing. Yeah. Because the first two, again, just to repeat for people, the first combat was a breakout, so it was very tactical, but it was also, this is what this mercenary company does. It right. fights as a unit, and it just happened that this combat, or it was actually planned that way, this combat was very much a military combat, and you guys were able to use them very tactically. And even with the Black Pudding, again, that was a military-style combat, so you were able to use them as a resource, and you used the numbers. After that, they were no longer a military unit.
Right, we had just lost so many of them, it didn't make sense
to even
put them in the
unit. And also,
the story,
you're going through corridors and stuff like that. This is like special forces. This is like a traditional adventure party.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to say I couldn't have switched them with rules and I didn't think of it, and make them a narrative asset or detriment, like, you know, a benefit or advantage or disadvantage, and done something like that with them. And I could have easily switched them. Another mistake I made is that we had done a trial or like a sample battle
right
prior to starting it, just to get a feel for the combat. And you guys wiped out. I did the challenge rating, matched it up, and you guys wiped them out. Like the mooks were nothing to you guys. So I was trying to make it more challenging for you guys, as Wayne identified, but I wasn't also then attaching mooks to kind of take on your mooks.
Yeah.
So I wasn't balancing the encounter sufficiently for the actual entire group. I was balancing it. I was creating challenges for you guys only.
Right. That's kind of what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So certainly I could have made adjustments in that respect, or I could have turned them, as Wayne suggests, at a certain point into just advantages and disadvantages. You think about the movie Black Hawk Down, and Bill Fincher's character is going, we're combat ineffective, we're combat ineffective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just reach that stage if you have a military campaign where it's like, okay, this group is combat ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer a resource. They're now going to be providing either advantages or disadvantages in your encounters.
Right.
Until you can, but maybe even the players can then make changes. They break into some sort of arsenal and are able to arm them. They recruit more to beef up the numbers. So that could even add a dramatic element to the game. You get the children and now you have child soldiers.
You could have, yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely some options if you were going to do a military campaign again there. So, maybe a bit more, as I said before, maybe a bit more, because you don't want to rely entirely on the dice, but yeah, there were a couple times where as a player I'm like, I don't know what the company would do, but I'm pretty sure my character would know what the company would do. So, there were a couple times I just wanted to make a roll and say, I know what to do, we do that.
I mean, that's tough. I definitely understand what you're saying. And one of the reasons is because if you're playing a military campaign, you want to feel a military campaign, and feeling a military campaign means doing military things.
Mm-hmm. And, giving orders, yeah.
Yeah, giving orders, and maybe breaking camp. You don't want to get into too much of the finer details of that. But what's the difference between breaking camp as a party of four adventurers and breaking camp as a group of 44. Well, it's how you're setting up the camp, you know, and what is what do the Romans do versus the Nine Walkers in Lord of the Rings? Well, you know, what was the difference there?
Right.
And that can, it's those little details that can give the game a little bit more flavor. So we kind of just do as much as you're comfortable with, but maybe I wasn't pushing you guys into anything, but then if I push you too far, then you'd be like, oh, I don't know what to do.
Right, right.
So yeah, that was definitely a balancing act there. And part of that could be starting it at sixth level, and then you're senior NCOs, you're officers, you've been doing this for years, but you could start like a military game at the beginning so people get accustomed to at least how does this mercenary company function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So.
No, but overall, I really enjoyed it, and as I said before, I would play 13th Age again.
I would play this as a longer campaign, the same game. It was really fun.
No, definitely. I walked away from this game being a fan of 13th Age. Yeah, definitely. It lived up to the promise when we looked at it, and really recommend it. And this ends our latest campaign confessions. Of course, we'd like to do these more often. It's just a chance of finding the time to play the games. But we're pretty excited about the next game that's coming up, which will be run by Wayne.
It's going to be a Leverage.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm definitely looking forward to playing that. And I hope you're looking forward to listening to what we thought of Leverage and what we thought of Wayne's game.
It sucked.
That's my plan. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlereedhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG, the one true source for RPGs.
See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.